Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Reopenings and lack of social distancing have caused huge surge numbers in southern states. In Texas, Florida, and Arizona, hospitals are feeling it. Could we also see the same thing in Maryland? As the region opens up, and restless residents itch to get out and enjoy themselves. Well, tonight we're looking into what one medical system is doing to address the possibilities of a summer surge. My guests are Nathaniel Richardson, Jr., President and CEO of the University of Maryland Capital Region Health, and Dr. Joseph Wright, MD, Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer for the University of Maryland Capital Region Health. If you have any questions about the readiness of these hospital systems in Maryland, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Mr. Richardson, Dr. Wright, thank you both for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Harold.
Well, thank you for having us.
Let me first start off with you, Dr. Wright. What is your biggest concern as you watch Maryland, and particularly Prince George's County, since it entered into phase two today? What's your biggest concern?
Well, Harold, from our perspective, the biggest concern is that we need to continue normal operations. We have a community that in many ways, as a function of the pandemic, has delayed care for chronic conditions and conditions that we would typically be seeing throughout the course of the last several months and on into the summer. And one of the concerns that we have as we prepare ourselves for continuing to deal with the COVID patients that are coming through is the delay in care for our patients with chronic conditions, diabetes, hypertension, chronic renal disease that have not been coming through the facility. And that is a huge concern for us because, of course, these patients will present to the medical system at a later stage and in more dire straits. So that's a concern for us and something that we definitely want to encourage those with these conditions and those families who are caring for members of the families with those conditions to please see us, and we are here for you to provide that ongoing care.
Why do you suppose that they are not coming?
Well, Harold, I think that there certainly is a lot of anxiety in the public, no question about it. Throughout the pandemic, one of the things that we've been stressing is the steps that all of our hospital systems throughout the region have been taking to protect our patients, protect our community when they enter our facilities. And I think that certainly the anxiety and concern about coming to a healthcare facility during the height of a pandemic has kept people home.
I wanted to ask Mr. Richardson. Mr. Richardson, you've officially been on the job for a month or so, and you're coming from North Alabama, where one of many southern states that are now seeing a bit of a surge there just over the past several weeks. What's different between where you're coming from and what you're now seeing in Maryland?
Well, I think certainly in Alabama, you had more rural areas that the surge just took longer to get there. I will tell you specifically the testing was behind in the state of Alabama, so it took a while to get some of the testing kits so that we can test more. And now as they have started to see the surge, I don't believe it's a delay in the virus itself, but a delay in testing. And as you know, you test more people, you have more positive results. When I look at the state of Maryland, they have been far ahead in preparation. They have gone through, of course, a surge, and certainly we hope to not go through the resurges we have seen. I'm originally from Houston, Texas, and I talked to my mother this morning. They are seeing a pretty substantial surge there. And the same thing there is, you know, the resurgence as they have opened, even though they have done it in phases, you know, there's a lot we don't know about this virus. And as we learn more about this virus, we can continue to plan and prepare for the future.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking about preparing for the possibility of a summer surge, particularly in the D.C. metro. Are hospitals ready for it? Let's go to Dee, calling from Arlington. Dee, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I've been thinking that all along that we're going to have a resurgence. Mm-hmm. I'm on unemployment right now, and my intention is to just, if it goes, it goes. And I just have been, like, buying things, and I want to get myself prepared to not have to come out till like, October. And so I'm stockpiling like crazy, but I just want to know if there are things that I should be thinking about just for myself to make sure that I can ride this out.
That's an interesting question. Dr. Wright, do you want to handle that, particularly as it relates to making sure that she stays healthy?
Well, Dee has the right approach in mind, because there has not been any change in the public health approach to this virus. We have not yet come up with a definitive treatment or a vaccine for the COVID-19 virus. So the same measures that the jurisdictions in the DMV have employed still need to be adhered to. So the physical distancing, and I call it physical distancing, Harold, because one of the things I want to stress for our community is that we need to stay socially connected. This is another important element of going through a pandemic of this nature, that while we maintain physical distance, we stay socially connected. And then universal mask wearing. These are the measures that we have, and limiting the contact in crowded environments until we have a vaccine and or definitive treatment for this virus. We can certainly expect that there will continue to be community spread unless these measures are adhered to. And one of the things that Maryland, you mentioned, Harold, coming just this evening, Prince George's County specifically, this evening coming into full phase two, we need to continue to stress the importance of the distancing and mask wearing as people come out into the communities and out into the public space.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking about what medical systems should do to address the possibility of a summer surge. Dee, thank you so much for your phone call. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call. One of the big issues that has been raised across the country and even in this region is PPE and other resources. In the event of a surge, Mr. Richardson, is the system, specifically your system, prepared for that? We certainly do not want to see the nightmare scenarios that we saw in New York and California and Washington State.
Yes, Aaron, thank you for that question. What I am proud of in coming here is that the University of Maryland Medical System has been preparing for their PPE and surges since they found out about how detrimental this disease could be. The system stood up an incident command structure to coordinate our readiness and our PPE equipment. What does that mean? When we stood up that structure, we could monitor all of our PPE equipment across the system, knowing the utilization at each of our 13 hospitals, and being able to reduce utilization where the COVID volume was not as high and increase it where volume was high. So we were able to develop a structure that allowed us to be extremely efficient with our PPE equipment. Each hospital is now with a volume of PPE equipment that will last us a certain number of days, and then we have our corporate structure and our corporate logistics center that we can get additional supplies from if we needed those supplies. But I think this incident command center has been a very good tool for us to be efficient with our personal protective equipment.
Earlier this year, maybe about 2 months or so ago, the Lowell Regional Hospital, which had been mothballed until this incident, had been, you know, repurposed for an outpatient facility, more than 200 beds and the like. Talk to me about what its status is right now, as we seem to have, for now, a hold on a sharp growth of this disease in Maryland.
So, yes, with our Laurel facility, floors 3, 4, and 5 specifically have been designated as COVID-19 floors. That has worked well for the system because we've been able to decant COVID patients from other system facilities so that they could focus on the Laurel campus by having all of the COVID patients cohorted in specific floors. It allows our nursing team members, our anesthesia, our physicians to work more efficiently and to learn as much as they can without having to spread out to various campuses. We will maintain the 3, 4, and 5 floors for as long as we need to in collaboration with the state as we continue to learn more about this COVID-19. All of the other services that have been offered at Laurel, our emergency department, our ancillary testing, diagnostic, imaging, is still available. And those floors are structured to where they're not commingled with other parts of the operations.
Mm-hmm. Also, I also want to ask about the facility in Cheverly, Dr. Wright, because, again, at the height of this pandemic in Maryland, all hospitals in the region were feeling the pinch. How would you characterize the status of the Cheverly facility right now?
Well, Harold, as you pointed out, at the outset of the surge in the state of Maryland, all of us in the healthcare industry responded to a mandate from the governor to expand capacity. And at the Cheverly campus, we literally doubled, if not tripled, our capacity, particularly for critical care patients on the Cheverly campus, as well as Mr. Richardson just described, at our Laurel campus, which added 135 total beds to our surge capacity. In Cheverly today, we are assessing the need to maintain particularly that level of critical care capacity as we move forward with restoring the normal care that we provide for our community. And I just want to emphasize, as I stated at the outset of this conversation, how important it is that we maintain normal operations for the community that we serve, which does suffer with a high degree of chronic illness and disparities that our communities uniquely see. So right now, Harold, we are both at the same time maintaining our capacity and critical care capacity for the COVID patients on the Cheverly campus while we are restoring our elective surgeries and our care for our chronically ill patients who need us.
In the event of a surge, would that be the reduction of other surgeries? Would that be the governor's call? Would that be Mr. Richardson's call? Would that be your call in the event that we see numbers tick back up?
Harold, we are watching those numbers daily, and I think that decision would be a collaborative decision, not just with the governor, but the Department of Health, our health officers, certainly Dr. Wright. We continue to watch our trends on a daily basis. and making sure that as we look at those trends, we're evaluating our ICU capacity, our surgery capacity, our ED capacity. So that certainly would be a collaborative decision.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tonight we are looking into what One Medical System, University of Maryland Medical System, is doing to address the possibility of a summer surge in the state of Maryland. My guests, of course, are Nathaniel Richardson, Jr., President and CEO of the University of Maryland Capital Region Health, and Dr. Joseph L. Wright. He is the Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer of the University of Maryland Capital Region Health. If you have a question or a comment, and now would be the time to give us a call, because, of course, we are going to take a break shortly. We can take your phone call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. This is a particularly critical conversation, as we have seen in some parts of the country, particularly southern and western states. We have seen a surge in COVID-19 infections, particularly with young people. So we're going to continue this conversation. What are things looking like in the capital region, and how we can keep you safe? So please stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on SiriusXM channel 141. A reminder that you can hear this in every discussion via podcast on whur.com. It's posted before 9 p.m. every evening. Stay with us. The original Quiet Storm continues on WHUR. This conversation continues on SiriusXM channel 141. And again, lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our discussion about what the University of Maryland Medical System is doing to address the possibility of a summer surge in the Capital Region. My guests are Nathaniel Richardson, Jr., President and CEO of the University of Maryland Capital Region Health, and Dr. Joseph Wright. He's Senior Vice President and Chief Medical Officer with the University of Maryland Capital Region Health. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Let me go back to the phone lines. Jeremy calling from Arlington. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Okay, good evening.
Hi.
Just one quick question. I'm noticing from a lot of the health professionals in the health medical field, no one is really talking about a holistic approach to protecting yourself outside of wearing a mask. What efforts, or why aren't we hearing that kind of information come out from health professionals about eating healthier, exercising more, fasting, doing things to boost your immune system so you can work from the inside out to help protect yourself from not only COVID, from just any other viruses that may come out, or any kind of health issues that can arise from COVID-related sickness?
Dr. Wright?
Jeremy, thank you for that question. And you're absolutely right. The more that we pay attention to our overall health, status, which includes our immune system, which, by the way, as we are looking for solutions to the this particular virus, which is a novel virus, by the way, never having been seen by humans, it is critically important that we do everything we can to bolster our baseline health. Holistic solutions, as you have talked about in terms of nutrition and exercise, are vitally important to maintaining our health. And certainly when we get to the point where we have a vaccine that is available for public consumption, the ability for us to mount that immune response to the vaccination will better protect all of us. And we have a public responsibility here, which makes Jeremy's question even more important. The more that we do personally to protect ourselves, the more that we protect ourselves, including our family members, and certainly focusing on our own health and well-being is vitally important here. And I really appreciate that question, Jeremy.
Jeremy, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. A follow-up to that, Dr. Wright, do you believe that the patients that you had an opportunity to interact with over the course of the pandemic are hearing that warning that so many health experts, including yourself, are issued around diet, exercise, in dealing with these comorbid issues? Or are they just, is it going in one ear and out the other?
Well, Harold, I have concerns about the level to which communication and messaging is being heard by the community writ large, not just in terms of the need for self-help, but I think also in terms of the measures that we are in need of maintaining in order to protect ourselves. I really do wonder, as I interact with patients and families, both inside and outside the hospital, how effective, or if we could be more effective, rather, in drilling down the importance of everything we're talking about tonight, which is why programs like this evening are so very important. I just am concerned that there are facets of our community that are not hearing the messaging, and that that are perhaps hard to reach, that we really need to work harder to communicate with and get this messaging to.
Harold, I will add that we have had perfectly normal and healthy individuals also have a great impact from the COVID-19. And what I would say to that is we're going to have to work with our epidemiologists to really get an understanding of how this virus attacked different individuals. I've seen individuals that were runners and exercise. They, take their vitamins and they do all of the things and they still have attracted COVID. So there's so much more to learn about this virus, so that once we determine all of those factors that are impacting our own health, we need to make sure that when we set a structure in the future for how we deal with COVID, you're going to have, I think, two pathways, those pathways with individuals that have multiple comorbidities and those individuals who don't.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. If you are listening and you're concerned about a surge, I'd like to hear from you. What specifically about the possibility of a surge in COVID-19 cases in the capital region? I'd like to hear what you have to say about that. Let's go to Steve, calling from Forestville. Steve, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
How you doing, yes?
I'm good.
I was negative, and I'm wondering how long do the test last a certain time? I've been around. I'm protesting. Should I get retested later on?
Wow, that's such an excellent question. Dr. Wright.
Yes, Harold, I didn't catch all of Steve's question, but I think he mentioned that he had tested negative and was asking about needing to be tested again. Is that the question?
Yes, because he's also been participating, I'm assuming, in the Black Lives Matter protests that we've seen in the region over the past several weeks.
Oh, good question, Steve. Yes, well, I tell you, the protests and the civil activity that is going on throughout the region, in fact, throughout the country, certainly presents a challenge in terms of the distancing that I talked about. And while many of the people who are participating are wearing masks, you raise an excellent question. And I certainly believe that the need to have a high level index of suspicion, as we call it in our business, for being tested. Certainly, if you have any symptoms, getting tested is a good idea. And the fact that you had tested negative previously certainly does not in any way impact what has happened since that test. And if you've been out and about and in the protest downtown or wherever, that could create a risk for you. And I would certainly have you contact your physician if you have concerns. But I just want to stress the importance of if you are symptomatic, you do need to contact your source of health care, and you may require another test if that is the case.
Steve, how old are you, if I may ask?
I am 64.
You're 64, so you sound like you're 34. But good. So you are in the high risk age group. Are you concerned about a possible surge?
I'm not. I wear my mask, and like I said, I eat healthy, and I try to stay healthy. But I haven't had any symptoms. But I also was around some other people. I usually keep my mask on. But I just want to make sure, should I be retested in this process?
Okay. Well, Steve, thank you so much for your phone call. I appreciate it. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. I want to go back to one of the other points as it relates to dealing with issues around communities of color. Because, Mr. Richardson, I think this is a really important point where we have, obviously, we've seen a lot of the people who have been demonstrating during the protests, and a lot of those people certainly people of color. But when you're talking about communities of color that are challenged with access to healthcare, food, and all of the the food deserts and all of the other issues that contribute to difficult health scenarios, where is the University of Maryland medical system when it works to play a part in addressing that? I mean, let's be honest. You're a hospital. Once they leave the offices or the hospital or the doctor's offices, they're kind of on their own until they need or want to come back.
You're exactly right, Harold. And I will tell you, as a health system, one of the things we're going through right now is our strategic plan, which transitions into our annual operating plan. And what we're looking at currently is when we bring up the new Largo facility and we bring up our new Laurel facility, what are the other needs in the community? So, for instance, in Cheverly, how do we continue to serve the residents in Cheverly? Prince George's County, of course, is a very, very large county. It's, over a million people right now. And we are right now strategically trying to determine where the access points needs the greatest. So, for instance, if we had to put a telemedicine structure in place to serve residents who can't get to Largo, we are evaluating all of those various access points as we speak, and that's how we're able to help the residents, specifically in Prince George's County, related to access. The other challenge we will have, and we'll have to work with our transit authority, we'll have to work with our county executives and other elected officials for those areas where they're more rural and trying to get those citizens to those access points, I think is critical. We have a deficit across the nation with primary care, and that's another challenge that we're evaluating, and how do we resolve the issue of primary care? It may, for instance, require models where we utilize more nurse practitioners, and they're being supervised by either internal medicine, family medicine, or doctors of osteopathic medicine. So those are some of the discussions we're having specifically to the statement and question that you had.
Mm-hmm. 202-31. Yeah, please go right ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to amplify one of the points that Mr. Richardson made as an unintended consequence of the pandemic is leveraging technology. all of our facilities have had to limit visitation, and we have uniquely had to leverage technology in order to keep families in communication with one another. So when Mr. Richardson mentioned the advent of the broader advent of telehealth, this is something that has definitely been an outcropping of our experience through the pandemic and leveraging, uniquely leveraging technology to keep people connected during times of needing to be distant.
Let me ask you about that real quick, because one of the things, and this really goes to the financial security and health of not just UMMS, but any health organization, because you're not going in to see a doctor. You're essentially now calling, telemedicine, phone call, telemedicine, laptop. What impact, if any, is that having on the financials of your health system? Is there a concern about losing money?
Yes, Harold. There is a concern because there is a lower fee under normal circumstances related to telehealth. Now, right now, we're under the CARES Act, and the government has done a great job trying to keep hospitals and health systems whole as it relate to telehealth. But once we are no longer under the pandemic at the levels that we are, I'm sure those rates would go back to normal rates. So we are going to have to re-engineer ourselves as health systems and try to understand how can we incorporate telehealth and remain financially strong. And that's just a matter of restructuring our organization. We are having those conversations. We don't have those answers today, but those are certainly discussions that we're having.
Mm-hmm. Because I would imagine that just for people who are just curious about how they're feeling compared to those who may have full-blown symptoms, but they are still at home, that is going to be one of the many layers that impacts UMMS and other hospital systems going forward. Just curious about that. And the reason I ask that is because I've called my doctor on the phone when I normally just go in. I've had friends talk about the fact that they have called their doctors or have utilized, the technology of telemedicine and have spoken about, the lower costs. And on one end, for a patient, that may be great, but on the hospital end, that raises a question, certainly.
Absolutely. And Harold, if you think about the halo effect of telemedicine, so for instance, if you go to a physician office that's fully loaded, meaning they have diagnostics, they have lab, they have other ancillary testing within their office, when you make a telehealth visit and you need to go down the hall for an x-ray or get lab, that's a much different dynamic when you're at home. So how do we make sure that if you've had a telehealth visit and based on that visit there's a need for diagnostics, how do we make sure that you are receiving those diagnostics and you're able to get there and have that appropriate follow-up? So again, those are discussions we will have to have, and we'll have to work out the new structure in this new environment, because COVID is not going anywhere anytime soon, and we're going to have to re-engineer our operations to make sure that we can serve and continue to provide the care that's needed.
Dr. Wright, a couple of questions for you. First of all, we've been hearing a lot over the past couple of weeks about remdesivir. Is it being utilized at the Cheverly campus? And if so, how would you grade it? Is it helping?
Well, remdesivir is a approved treatment that is being distributed in limited quantity. There is not, Harold, a great supply of remdesivir, and the distribution of remdesivir has been at a system level, and we certainly have had some patients who have received remdesivir, and it is a treatment that has worked for some, and being still evaluated for others. There are other adjunct medications, Decadron, a steroid that has been used in adjunctive therapy with remdesivir that seems to help. We are learning a great deal, Harold. We have learned a great deal, Harold, over the past 4 months, not only in terms of therapeutics, but literally learning new tricks. The way that we use ventilators has evolved over the course of the last 4 months.
How
the
so?
The aggressiveness with which we treat patients has evolved. So, yes, we're using remdesivir and learning a great deal as we move along.
You said the way that ventilators are being used has evolved. How so?
Yes, we have learned the benefit of putting patients in a prone position when they are on a ventilator, meaning on their stomach as opposed to on their back, as a therapy for patients who are being ventilated. We've learned the value of really drying patients out when they're on a ventilator. So these are some of the nuances of the practice of medicine in the COVID era, so to speak, that we are learning and learning from colleagues all around the country as we, as Mr. Richardson said, learn more and more about how this virus is physiologically impacting our communities.
Help me a little bit as I'm still working on my medical degree. When you say drying patients out, what do you mean by that?
Yes, what I mean by that is diuresing them, meaning to really make sure that there is no excess fluid in the lungs, for instance, that might be impacting the way that they are responding to being on the ventilator. So when I say drying patients out, I literally mean using diuretics to make sure that there's not excess fluid. So these are just some of the, again, over the course of the last 4 months, some of the tricks that we've learned along the way to more effectively manage our COVID patients.
One of the other things that we saw during the pandemic, during the height of the pandemic, was the human factor. The nurses and the doctors who were on the front lines of the pandemic, particularly in places like New York and Los Angeles and in Washington State. Has there been any discussion about making sure that you have enough staff and that the staff is not burned out in the event of a surge?
Yes, absolutely, Harold. I'll let Mr. Richardson pick up on the back end, but I want to just share what something that organically evolved in our organization early on. I mentioned the importance of physical distancing, not social distancing. You can imagine the impact on a heavily impacted staff like ours, of being in PPE all day long. We converted several units into COVID-only units where individuals would be in this personal protective equipment all throughout the entire shift. Well, our staff created a serenity room on two of our campuses. And the serenity room was a place where the staff could literally disconnect, get out of their equipment, remove themselves from the clinical environment and really retreat in a way that would allow them to restore, refresh, and get back to the job. And this was something I was very, very proud to see evolved, as I said, organically. This didn't come from administration. This was something that emerged from the staff themselves. And the Serenity Room has been a place where inspirational messaging on our message boards happens. And I'm just so proud of the way that the staff has responded to support one another, to stay socially connected in support of one another through this.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Richardson, your thoughts about that human factor?
Absolutely, Harold. One of the things that we have tried to be very cautious and making sure that we understand is COVID fatigue. You've heard about it. And that's with our team members having to wear this equipment, as Dr. Wright stated, all day long. Sometimes you can get laxed and just tired of having to wear the equipment. So we have a lot of different motivational type activities and fun activities that we try to incorporate in our daily environment so that we are not as fatigued and we get our mind off of having to wear all of the equipment, even though they still must wear it. We try to at least balance their minds on a day-to-day basis. And that's very, very important to us. We try to make sure that our faces as leaders in the organization are seen. We don't want to be back in offices and have our frontline team members out on the front lines and them not see us back in administration. So while we have to continue to make sure that we're following the distancing rules as well, we try to be visible so that our team members can talk to us and see us.
Do you have the staff for a possible surge? I know there were when you were ramping up the facility in Laurel, there was a lot of hiring going on. Can I put in a shameless plug for all of those nurses graduating from the Howard University School of Nursing? So do you have the staff to handle a possible surge?
So we staff by a matrix methodology, and we do have access to all of those agencies that provide staff. We also have an incentive program in place for team members to work additional shifts, and they get paid after they've, you know, worked a certain number of shifts, which also motivates them to come in. So we have two different pathways to staff our organization. One is through the agencies in which we have partnerships with. The second is through the incentive programs that we have internally for internal team members. But we try to make sure that there's a balance there because, as you stated, they work a lot of hours and we don't want to burn them out. But for those individuals who do prefer to come in and work extra shifts, they are rewarded for those extra shifts.
Mm-hmm. I only have a few minutes left, and we've been speaking mostly about the possibility of a summer surge. But the reality is, as we have heard Dr. Anthony Fauci at NIH discuss, we could see a second wave or something that looks like a second wave when flu season kicks up. What are your plans to address that in addition to the pandemic issues in the event that by some miracle we don't have a vaccine or this goes away, if I may, Mr. Richardson?
Sure. So right now, to address the flu season and a potential bilateral COVID surge in the fall, we have some pods that we have partnered with the state on, which gives us additional capacity to place some of the COVID patients within these pods. There are additional pods available that we have not gotten our hands on yet because, again, we're watching our weekly data to make sure from a standpoint of surges we can see it coming and determine how much of our access capacity we need to activate. So we continue to look at that, and if we needed additional resources like pods, we would work with through the state and our county executives as well as other elected officials.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts, final thoughts, Dr. Wright?
No, again, Harold, we just want to thank you for allowing us to have this discussion. I think your point earlier about messaging and communication to the public is critically important. We can't over-communicate about this pandemic and the measures that we need to take to keep ourselves and our communities safe.
Well, I certainly want to thank both of you for spending some time with us in this really important discussion during this very, very critical time. Dr. Joseph Wright, again, thank you so much for your work over there in Cheverly. And Nathaniel Richardson, welcome to Maryland.
Thank you so much, Harold. And thank you to WHUR and the efforts that you're doing to keep our community informed. This is very important. I would add that as we go into this 4th of July holiday weekend, that we remember that we are seeing many states surge. It's over 30 states, and we just need to be diligent in how we approach our social activities over this weekend.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the most important things happening right now, particularly as it relates to young people who may be infected and may be asymptomatic. So important. So, again, gentlemen, thank you so much. Good luck and stay safe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That is the Daily Drum for this Monday, June 29th. I'm Harold Fisher. Now, stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.